This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with the editor of a new book titled The War Before, the story of Black Panther and political prisoner Safia Bukhari.
Laura Whitehorn, who spent 4 years putting this book together, gives us an idea of what it's like to be a radical black woman in the 60s, in the Black Panther Party, in prison, and later organizing for the release of so many political prisoners.
We'll hear an update on Mumia Abu-Jamal's court case. Nearly 30 years without a semblance of justice.
Our guest, Professor Johanna Fernandez, a frequent visitor to Mumia, gives us the current facts and situation that Mumia is facing.
We'll hear a speech from the recent report back of the historic March on Gaza from Palestinian teacher and filmmaker Fida Kishta. Stay with us.
War Before, the story of Black Panther and political prisoner Safia Bukhari. We're delighted to have political activist and former Weather Underground member Laura Whitehorn back with us to talk about her new book titled The War Before. Laura introduces us to Safia Bukhari, a member of the Black Panther Party in the late 1960s. The War Before traces Safia's life commitments of organizing around the rights of the oppressed. Through Safia's personal writings, we hear her unique perspective of what had happened to the Black Panther Party and her personal insights into the incarceration of outspoken radicals. Safia, herself a longtime political prisoner and jailhouse activist, died in 2003. It was at the request of Safia's daughter Wanda that Laura assembled and edited The War Before. Laura Whitehorn has been a political activist since the 1960s. She spent 14 years in prison for involvement in the resistance conspiracy case. Released in 1999, she lives in New York City and now is a senior editor at PAS magazine. We're also joined by Sundiata Sadiq. He's a leading member of the Free Mumia Coalition in New York City and was a close friend of Safia's for many years. Sundiata has been politically active since the late 60s, and he was also the president of the Ossining, New York chapter of the NAACP. Laura Whitehorn, Sundiata Sadiq, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Laura, you really have our admiration for putting 4 years of your life into the production of this book. It looks gorgeous, I have to say, for listeners who can't see the technicolor on a radio airwave. The War Before, this true life story of Safia Bukhari, and then it's in different colors, becoming a Black Panther, keeping the faith in prison, and fighting for those left behind, and then forward by Angela Davis, afterward by Mumia, and finally that you edited it and wrote the introduction. Wonderful job, Laura. I know it was four years of the labor of love here, and it really shows. How did you come to a point you describe in the book where you were in prison in Dublin, California, in a women's prison, and she came out to meet you? How did you get to where you were, and how did she get to where she was doing the political prisoner support work?
Safia and I had not the same trajectory at all, but parallel trajectories during the 60s and 70s of people who came to awareness of the fact that the United States was never going to be reformed as a system through international events and domestic ones. And I'm white, she was black. We were in different movements, but they were parallel movements, and they acted in solidarity with one another. And both of them, both of these strands in the movements for freedom, focused on a couple of things. One was on the liberation of black people in the United States, the awareness that, as she says in this book, there have been some changes in the conditions of black people, but they're mostly cosmetic and mostly to buy people off, and we're still at the bottom. And once I realized that through my own experience of growing up in America, I wanted to fight to change it. And I did, and I'm not going to go through my whole history because I would like people to buy the book. And in the introduction, I had to tell some of it. But I ended up with, at that point, I think it was five other women political prisoners, two of my co-defendants, and then four women from the Puerto Rican independence movement in the federal women's prison in Dublin, California. Whoever we were, as political prisoners, we would have met Safia, because she, when she got out of prison in 1983, she made it her business to go and visit and fight for every political prisoner in this country that she could get to who wanted to be part of a movement to free political prisoners. And I want to make one point that she makes in this book, in one of the essays, actually over and over, which is that the fight for the freedom of political prisoners cannot be separate from the fight against repression in general, whomever that is affecting. So if she were alive today, I believe she would have been at the rally 2 weeks ago for Fahad Hashmi. She would have been fighting for the rights of the detainees and the immigrant detainees, and also the detainees in the quote-unquote war on terror, the terrifying war on terror by the United States. Because she said over and over again, political prisoners arose and will continue to arise if people oppose the government. And we have to do that if we want to fight for justice. And if we miss the point of where people came from who are now in prison, then we will miss the next wave of political prisoners. So I met her when she came in as a paralegal, which is what she was. It was right after we had done the prisoners, the women political prisoners in San Francisco, had with people on the outside done an art show for Mumia Abu-Jamal to raise funds and awareness. It was at the beginning of her building the Jericho March, which is talked about at length in this book and analyzed.
Sundiata Sadiq, how did you first come to meet Safia?
Yes, I met Safia back in in the early 70s. She was pregnant with Wanda, her daughter, and she had came up with Robert Webb to Rockland County. At that time, I was head of an organization called the Black Liberation Front. Robert, I don't know, was around 21 or Huey, Free Huey. I remember Robert having on a Free Huey t-shirt. The next thing, Robert and I did some work together when he had a beef with the CPUSA around some money. In 1984, Bill Kunstler installed me as head of the Austin NAACP, and Yuri Kuchiyama contacted me, I think it was about 83, 84, to write a letter to Safia for her parole. We had a party when she got out at Safia's house, Yuri's house, and, you know, she said, you know, I never thought anybody in the NAACP would write a letter of my parole. So, and then we became friends. Her and my wife bonded, and she used to come up to the house on weekends just to get away. In fact, when my wife passed away, she spoke and she sang a song at her funeral, and she said this was the place that she would escape from all the stress and, strain of the struggle.
This book began with Wanda. This book, you remember that. This book began when Wanda, after Safia died, when Wanda said her papers are here and they are not going to be just lost. And that's what began this book. So you said I had been working on this for 4 years, which, by the way, I was doing it every weekend for 4 years after work. But Wanda has too. And Wanda actually, because of her own struggles of, you know, coming to know her mother as a political person and all that, which she talks about in the preface, has actually been working on this book in some ways for her entire life.
Yeah, that was one of the things that Safia and my wife talked about. And, you know, we had two children, and Safia felt she was trying to find out if she did something to leave the space between her and her daughter, because her daughter was kind of resentful. And I'm sure if she's looking down on us now, she would look at this book and the work that Wanda did. And it was a complete change from the time that we were talking about how sons and daughters of political prisoners may react to their parents not being around.
Mm. We're talking about the book The War Before, the true life story of Safia Bukhari, which was edited by Laura Whitehorn, who's here in the studio with us, with Safia's comrade, Sundiata Sadiq.
During Safia's time in prison, she spent nearly half of it in solitary confinement. And she writes she was kept in maximum security because she was, quote, a threat to the security of the free world. What did she mean by that?
Well, I mean, from what you gather from all of her writing is that the free world is said very sarcastically as, you know, Mumia in his afterword refers to Safia's sarcasm sometimes and her sense of humor. Safia was very aware at all the time that the, quote, freedom, the, quote, democracy that this country promotes as its image only exists on the suffering of so many people. And where her political history began, she describes this, is when she was in college in Brooklyn, and she was going to be a pre-med student, and she went with her black sorority in college up to Harlem to see whether they couldn't do something about the needs of children in Harlem. They had started out thinking they would help children around the world who were suffering from poverty or this or that, and they decided instead to go up to Harlem and see what was going on there. And she was horrified by the conditions she saw, not so much just by the conditions as by the fact that the government did nothing to address those. So when she talks about the Panther Party, and Wanda talks about this in her preface too, they talk about the fact sickle cell testing. Okay, nowadays sickle cell testing is common in black communities. But in the time of the Panthers, there was very, very little, none in some communities. And the Panthers were the ones who started those programs. So now, you know, people hear about breakfast for children and free health clinics, all that stuff. And it sounds sort of like, oh, yeah, don't tell me about that again. But when you put it in the historical on-the-ground context, which is what some of her writings talk about, you realize that stuff was built out of nothing. And to address the, quote, free world and how free it is for other people. So her politics were a challenge to the government all along. Her being was a challenge.
Just to extend the little bit of autobiographical information, it's really a wonderful accounting of a person who comes to political consciousness. And she recounts how she was one of 10 children in the Bronx, right, and her parents had kids every 2 years for 20 years. She said that she sympathized with what the Panthers were doing in providing breakfast for children, and she got to be part of that. But she wasn't politically sympathetic with them until that incident, and you recall it for us, Laura, when she came upon a Panther trying to sell the newspaper on the street.
The Panther was stopped by the cops. I think it was in Times Square. And this is kind of funny for me because I actually had a very similar situation when I was first coming to consciousness. You see, I saw the cops stopping a black young man on the street in Chicago, and I tried to intervene and say, I saw him, officer, he wasn't doing anything, and I got thrown to the side. Well, Safia, being black instead of white, got put in the police car and threatened with all kinds of brutality from the police, which people in New York should not be shocked at, as we're watching yet another trial of police brutalizing a young man.
Yeah, with a baton.
And she woke up. She says the rose-colored glasses were stripped from her eyes.
Yeah, I think one of the things, because Safia's mother had been to my house, and when you look at the religious training, they were Pentecostal. The family was Pentecostal, what we call in the black community, sanctified, charismatic people. So that transformation into the Panthers, that was heavy. And when we went to, Safia's funeral, you saw the dichotomy between an RNA burial and then her brother, I believe, was a preacher, and they had a, Pentecostal-type service. So that was pretty heavy for me.
I believe, Laura, it was in your introduction that you said Safia mourned for a serious movement for change and some serious organizing. And throughout the book, so many people recount the fact that she was, of so many, the hardest worker, really a day-to-day organizer, which I think Malcolm X said was really the difficult part, educating, changing ourselves.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I like best about the book, and, I've spent a lot of hours looking at these papers and the others that we couldn't fit in to the book. But what I'm struck by is that Safia's essays, some of these are essays, some of them are speeches, were never, okay, now I am going to talk about this subject, and here's the beginning, here's the middle, here's the end. She was investigating. She was questioning. She was looking at, what was it in our movement that allowed the government to create such terrible, terrible tragedy out of what began as the most amazing organization that this country has probably ever seen? But the other thing that comes across is that she's willing to look at herself, at her own weaknesses, at what each of us brings into a movement. And that's something, that kind of honesty, I think is really necessary. And I'm feel when I'm done with this, with reading this whole book, I feel that there is a connection between her humility, her honesty, and her commitment, because this is not someone who was a star you know, the media has chosen certain people from certain movements and put them up there, and the media plays on that whole sense of the Panthers as having been just about militancy and just about self-defense. And this book is one of a number to challenge that view, to crack it into pieces and to say, no, this is what it was. And not only that, but the Panthers were not separate. I mean, here we have Sadiq sitting here, who was involved in other black liberation organizations. And history, because it's been so shallow to this point a lot, has divided these eras and these parts of the struggle in separate boxes and the organizations separate. But it wasn't like that. There was a lot of interplay, and there's a lot of continuum.
Quite agreed. This book is really about, you know, who writes history and how do we understand it. The War Before, edited by Laura Whitehorn. Laura, I wanted to congratulate you for the scholarship that went into this book, the footnotes, the index. It has a list of resources. And it has a description of what happened to some 75 people who lost their lives in the struggle. It has a list of people who are still in prison. And it's very, very helpful to have this. It's unique. It's a book that really cried out to be produced, and you did it, and we're thankful to you.
Could you speak a bit about Safia's role in founding the Jericho Movement?
Safia, when she would come to my house, she would tell me about, you know, the Momia Coalition, which she co-founded, and Jericho, and she would always try to get me to come and be a part of it. I would come to the marches, but, you know, between the NAACP and dealing with backward Negroes in the organization and, you know, trying to put forth a progressive thing in Austin and Sing Sing, because we had a chapter in Sing Sing, which I want to say what Safi did when she went into prison, it was hard. So I really don't know that much about the founding of Jericho. I know I became close to Herman Ferguson and Safia and, you know, went to the marches that they had in D.C. and stuff. But I really didn't take a position and being part of it, you know.
But which Sadiq hasn't even had a chance to read yet because the book is just out, there is a chapter, Questions and Answers, about Jericho. And I was in prison when Jericho was founded. I designed some artwork for them. I was completely supportive of it because it was going to be a national coalition for the freedom of political prisoners. I never fully understood the genesis of it until I read her papers and what Jaleel Muntakim, who was very influential in it, yes, wrote about, and what Herman Ferguson and Ialua Ferguson told me about it. And what's interesting is that she saw it originally. It had begun years before as a project of the Republic of New Africa, and it was focused on black political prisoners, who for many years there were black political prisoners and Puerto Rican political prisoners, and the white anti-imperialists started later coming into prison. And that had stopped for a few years, and so they wanted to reinitiate it. But she saw it as a coalition with representatives of organizations doing housing, organizations doing work in public health, organizations serving the people, not political prisoner organizations. But that is not what we have been able to sustain, because there has been a gap between the general social justice movements and the movement of support for political prisoners. And I think that is something I'm hoping the book will help us address. And I wanted to say, Mike, that was very sweet what you said about my scholarship. But and I did do the footnotes, and believe me, that was hard because a lot of this information is hard to find. But those lists have been generated by the Jericho Movement, the people who keep that going, by the Mumia Coalition, by Sadiq, by people. And that's the other point about this. There's some scholarship coming out now about the relationship between women in the black struggle and the struggle overall. Right. So there's another book called Want to Start a Revolution, Radical Women in the Black Freedom Struggle, which I just read, which is all about all these different women, and Safia is mentioned in it, who were active. But it's not just women. It's also people like Sadiq. It's also people like me, organizers on the ground. And that's what it takes to build a movement.
Yeah, I just want to say something about it because, you know, sometimes we keep a lot of things quiet. You know, I found that brothers, ex-Panthers, Panthers, were very jealous of, to me, Safia. And we talk about it at some time. And I was talking to Laura about when they formed the Panther Collective. I'm not calling any names, but she had came to my house and talked about forming a Panther Collective of, you know, ex-Panthers. They're going to put out a paper. She brought up the first copy to the house. I think I still have it. But these brothers got, you know, jealous, I believe, and they actually kicked her out of the Panther Collective, you know, and that was kind of shocking to a lot of us. And just let me say one thing about when she would come to Austin. I had her in the Baptist church, and the Negro minister there, after she spoke, said that Satan was in the church. But Safia got a standing ovation from a packed church because she talked about AIDS and how it affected the black community, a little bit about her life. Then she asked me, could I get into Sing Sing prison to talk to the brothers? We went down to the prison with, I don't know, it was Jennifer Dorn or I'm not sure. One of the Dorn sisters. When we got to the prison, they let Safia and Dorn in, but they said that Lieutenant Sullivan, who's head of security, said I was a security risk and they wouldn't let me in. So that was a big joke among all the prisoners that this member of the Black Liberation Army and somebody in the underground got into prison and the head of NAACP couldn't come in.
Shows their sexism.
Well, you also, I just want to ask, I was interested to learn that Safia actually escaped because of poor medical conditions. And usually when someone has escaped from a facility, things become harsher for them, and yet she was able to get parole. How was that?
Well, I think it was a different era. And this is one of my beefs about the prison system now, is that when we say, you know, people who've been in prison for 36 years, like Herman Bell, or even more than that, 38, I think 37 for Jaleel, you know, long, long, long times, Ruchel McGee for, I don't know, 46 years. When we say, okay, parole, release, we're told, oh, no, 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 that would denigrate the seriousness of the crime. And there had been at one point in this country a sense that you went to prison to be punished for having broken the law, and then at a certain point, you had been punished and you could be released. Now it's just permanent punishment. She was shocked that she got released. Mm-hmm. She was very surprised. I kind of think they wanted her out of there too, because she was doing a lot of great organizing. And she'll say, she was in Goochland, Virginia, and they had not seen a political prisoner there before. And women's prisons to this day have fewer resources than men's prisons. But there have been some struggles. I mean, when I was first in prison, the jails I was in, there was no library, nothing, no legal books. You couldn't, you know, research your case. That was the case in Goochland when she got there. Well, she spoke up, and I'm sure they were anxious to get her out of there. So they said, give this woman parole. And she had actually, she didn't win her escape case exactly, but she did win the jurors over so that they actually said to her after they had to convict her of escape, we wish we hadn't had to do it, because she had serious, serious fibroids. And she could not get operated on. And by the time when she got back and she used her trial for escape to argue for medical care, they had to remove her whole uterus because the fibroids were so bad and she was very ill. But, you know, that's some creative thinking.
You know, I couldn't help but think that the poor medical care that she got over those 8 years contributed to her early death. She was only 53 when she died. She was born in 1950 and she passed in 2003, really prematurely. And I think it's the combination of terrible food and poor medical care, the way people are treated, that kind of accelerates.
And she talks about...
Well, I want to differ with you there, brother, because Safia was under a lot of stress from some of these brothers in the organization. You know, there was a power play where people were trying, you know, and not only her, but Pam Africa, which still goes on today, women, strong women in leadership roles. So she was suffering from that kind of stress because she would come to the house and talk about, you know, she would name certain people saying this and saying that. And so I saw her breaking out, you know. You know, we're trying to tell her to relax. My wife was telling her to come to the house, you know, take a break, you know, that type of thing. But she was under a lot of pressure from, you know, just rumor mongering, things like that. And when this sister got her driver's license, first thing she would do was shoot up to Auburn to see Jaleel. Go here, go there, you know. I mean, I don't know how she had, you know, all that kind of energy. But I believe with a combination of that, you know, your comrades who you once worked with, you know, jockeying for position, I think that hurt her a lot.
In fact, in the February issue of the Monthly Review, We were able to get an excerpt from one of the Safia's chapters that's in the book in there. It's on post-traumatic stress syndrome in the Black Panther Party. And she talks about, and I think this is really not understood, that what went on, okay, here's the Panthers, young people. And I remember this, I was friends with Fred Hampton. When the cops and the FBI did what they did, when they came in, it wasn't just the rumor mongering and the fake letters and this and that, the kind of thing that produced what Sadiq's talking about and played on it. But also when they came in shooting and killed people and set people up and sent Geronimo to Pratt right. to prison for 27 years, they knew that he was framed and wouldn't do anything. Those sorts of things. Safia talks about how when the Panthers started out, they believed, and I believed at that time, in victory. We believed that we were going to win. And even though we weren't completely sure of it, we knew that we were fighting for a reason. We weren't two steps out of the starting gate when the cops let loose against the Black organizations and the Puerto Rican organizations and the Native American organizations. And the death and destruction was terrifying. I mean, really terrifying to see that. You've seen the pictures of Fred Hampton's body shot up. Twyman Myers, right. Pam Hanna and other people talked about how they had to go to the funeral home to dress his body so his mother wouldn't see the bullet holes. That sort of thing creates post-traumatic stress. And yet no one recognized that, so there was no way of healing. And one of the things that Safia was involved in was creating women's retreats in the Panthers that were about healing. But as Sadiq said, I'm sure they didn't get a lot of support from the men. And so those things also, and just the last thing I would say is, I feel like her heart broke at a certain point. Because, and I feel this too, it's wonderful that I got out of prison, that the Puerto Rican political prisoners got out of prison, that, you know, Clinton gave them clemency, that he gave clemency to two of my co-defendants, Linda and Susan. But meanwhile, he didn't give clemency to Leonard Peltier. No one has given clemency or any break to the many, many Black political prisoners who have been in way longer than I was. You know, when I got off parole, the first thing I did was go visit Herman Bell. And my girlfriend said to me, is this going to be flashbacks? And I said, no, because the second I stepped into that prison, I was so aware of the difference between having a life sentence and knowing that you're hated by the police and the government and that your chances of getting out are very slim and you have to really fight and have a lot of community support versus me who had a finite sentence. You know, it was not short, but it was finite. And so I think that for Safia, that was, I mean, I'm projecting here, that was a hard thing, seeing her comrades getting less and less support as the years went by. And I think that's part of the problem, is that there's huge interest in the 60s. You know, I get asked, oh, what was it like? You were in the Weather Underground. But I would like people to be as passionately interested in the conditions that Herman Bell faces, you know, an hour and a half from this studio, the Jaleel Muntakim that Abdul Majid faces, and Sundiata Kohli, and these wonderful, wonderful people who just were trying to make things better for their people.
You know, I think that your efforts are going to be rewarded in you're producing, Laura Whitehorn, and producing The War Before, the true life story of Safia Bukhari. Give a little description, please, of what people can expect if they go out and pick up this beautiful book, The War Before.
Well, as Angela Davis says in her preface, Safia's writings and her life reveal her to be one of the very best examples of dedication to radical change and to revolutionary social justice. And she takes us, Safia takes us from the 60s to, the last essay was in 2002. And that is a history not only of the movements of those years, but of how repression developed in those years, how the prison, the gross over incarceration of young Black and Puerto Rican and other Latino youth has affected the community. How people who set out to change the world in those days, how are people still trying to change the world? You will get that. You will get a sense of a woman who struggled with the issues about all these movements that we don't think about, like what Sadiq was talking about in the beginning about children, our relationship to children. Wanda's preface talks about that, her relationship to her mother. Why has the government been so determined to execute Mumia Abu-Jamal? She goes back through his whole history and ties it to the history of the counterintelligence program. Facts that you just won't get anywhere else. And when I was finally putting the end on the manuscript and read it through, I realized I would like people to read this book from beginning to end. And I think it's an easy read, even though it's nonfiction. It's very, her tone is very conversational, and you know, she laughs at different points, and then she makes fun of herself, and she makes fun of things that we should make fun of, and then she comes back and says, but this is what was good about it. You know, it's sort of like having a party with an old friend.
Laura Whitehorn, Sundiata Sadiq, thank you very much, Laura, for producing The War Before. Thank you too for coming on to Law and Disorder.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
The United States Supreme Court recently reopened the possibility that Pennsylvania may execute award-winning journalist and world-renowned, quote, voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal. The High Court referred his case back to the Third Circuit to reconsider its 2008 decision that Mumia could have a new penalty phase hearing in light of the court's ruling in the Ohio case of Smith v. Spisak. Spisak's jury-imposed death sentence had been reversed when his attorneys, like Mumia's, successfully invoked a critical 1988 Supreme Court decision in the Mills v. Maryland case. Mills rejected the idea that jurors had to be unanimous on the mitigating circumstances that existed in a case. Before Mills, juries had little or no alternative but to impose death if even one juror blocked consideration of a mitigating circumstance. The High Court's recent decision regarding that Mills claim will now make it easier to obtain death sentences in all capital cases. Mumia's attorneys will argue that his case is distinguishable from Spisak's. As many people know, Mumia was convicted and sentenced to death in 1981 for the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner. A previous guest here on Law and Disorder was author-journalist J. Patrick O'Connor, who wrote the book The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and who says that the real shooter was Kenneth Freeman, a business partner of Mumia's brother. Freeman was found dead in 1985, bound and cuffed in a Philadelphia parking lot. We are joined today by Johanna Fernandez, a member of the group Educators for Mumia and a native New Yorker. She received her PhD in history from Columbia University and a BA in literature and American civilization from Brown University. Welcome, Johanna, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've been very involved in Mumia's case for a number of years. One of the ways in which you're involved is through your participation in Educators for Mumia. Can you briefly tell us what that group does?
Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal is an organization that emerged in the 1990s to build the profile of Mumia Abu-Jamal on college campuses amongst educators and students. And just this last Saturday, we had a special consultation at Princeton University where we discussed the latest developments in the case, and where we brainstormed about how to really raise the profile of the most important death penalty case today on college campuses to a new generation of young people who entered college campuses after the height of the movement in the 1990s. Part of what we're trying to do is launch a town hall meeting scheduled tentatively for April 3rd, at which Kathleen Cleaver and Vijay Prashad are scheduled to speak. These are high-profile academics. We're also trying to figure out a way to make MUMIA part of a mainstream discussion about what is wrong with the criminal justice system. We are trying to possibly get a hip-hop show going in the Philadelphia schools for spring break so that we can have a huge hip-hop rally at Temple, at UPenn, at Haverford, and Swarthmore in Philadelphia, the belly of the beast, in part because since the last Supreme Court decision, which was a terrible decision for MUMIA and his defense team, the DA's office and the police are essentially celebrating and saying that MUMIA is innocent and that the Supreme Court's decision proves that he's a cop killer. What we want to do is actually turn that narrative around and raise the profile of the case and the gross violations of this case in Philadelphia. So part of what Educators from MUMIA Abu Jamal attempts to do is to really educate the public, young people, students, with the details of the case that are particular to MUMIA's life, but also that speak to the gross, again, violations, the major problems in the criminal justice system, a system that, as we know, incarcerates 3 million people. Essentially, that's the size of San Francisco. A nation that has to incarcerate so many people is a nation that is undergoing some kind of crisis in its legal system.
One could say it's a nation very much afraid. And I think the idea of those events in Philadelphia is so wonderful because the system in Pennsylvania, the police problems that we've had for decades there, present a discussion platform about how prosecutors have improperly worked with police. We've gone over on this show, Law and Disorder, a lot of the constitutional violations that happened in MUMIA's case. We have to address this sort of in the whole big picture of a criminal justice system that unfairly keeps people in prison without the benefit of a fair trial. How long have you yourself known MUMIA?
I've known MUMIA for about 5 years. I met him when I was a member of the faculty at Carnegie Mellon, which is in Pittsburgh, and only an hour away from Waynesburg, where he sits on death row at SCI Green. I have used MUMIA in the classroom live through a phone conference, and he speaks on issues as diverse as the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, his participation in the Black Panther Party, problems with the criminal justice system today. These live conferences with my students are incredibly powerful, and the recurrent theme in discussions with my students is that they are just fascinated and awed by the sobriety of his analysis and his voice and the calmness with which he delivers his message, especially given the gross violations in his case. And at this event in at Princeton, my colleague Mark Taylor, who's a faculty member in the Princeton Theological Seminary, said that part of what is fascinating and important about MUMIA is that he has the respectability of an anchorman, and yet his message is transgressive. And I thought that that really wonderfully captured the essence of the voice that we now have come to admire, the voice from death row, which MUMIA projects weekly right here on WBAI.
One of the things that always strikes me about MUMIA is that he doesn't dwell on his own situation. It transcends to really have an abstraction that has relevance to everyone. We waited, I guess it was about 8 months ago, the Supreme Court denied certiorari, meaning they would not hear an appeal in his case. However, the district attorney's office had also filed, in light of the Third Circuit's 2008 decision, that a new penalty trial be heard on the issue of the so-called Mills claim. Can you give us an update about this and what it means?
As you mentioned, just last week, the Supreme Court issued this very dangerous decision in Mumia's case. And essentially, what the Supreme Court did was that it reversed or set aside a decision of the lower court to vacate the death penalty.
We're speaking with Johanna Fernandez on the Mumia case. Johanna, I understand that you've recently visited Mumia. Can you give us a little feel for what it was like when you went in there and what you talked about?
You probably heard that the journey to visit Mumia is horrifying and dehumanizing. The facility itself, it's again very antiseptic and very cold, literally. The facility is freezing, and you're not allowed to wear warm garments because I imagine they fear that you might be hiding something that you're going to give to the inmate that you're visiting. But in the case of death row inmates, you visit and the person on death row is behind a plexiglass window. There's no contact between the visitor and the inmate. Mumia is an incredible conversationalist, and conversations and visits are incredibly intense. We talk about politics, Obama, and Obama's shortcomings, of course. We talk a lot about, and I ask him questions about what life is like on death row, how big his cell is. His cell is the size of a small bathroom, and he's only allowed 20 books at any given time. His cell happens to be very messy because he's a researcher, a writer, a journalist, and he's always working on some project. He's only allowed 2 hours outside of his cell, so he's in his cell 22 hours. I talk a lot about what he eats. He tells me that the food at the facility is absolutely horrendous, but they are allowed to buy food that's different from food that's served. And he says that that's nominally better. However, or he says that it's significantly better, but I asked him to describe what exactly the food looks like, and it's essentially the commissary sells food that is dried up in bags, and prisoners literally have to cook the food in its bag by pouring hot, scorching water on it. And that kind of brings the food to life.
Johanna, that sounds like MRE, or meals ready to eat, that they use in the military.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that the prisoners pay a pretty penny for this prepackaged dry food. And the servicing of inmates is, as you know, a $1 billion industry in this country.
And how were his spirits last time you saw him?
His spirits change. At the beginning of the visit, he's usually down and appears saddened or depressed, but he perks up as the visit progresses.
He's an intellectual, and I understand that through the discourse that you two have and others have with him, it reinvigorates him because he's such a thinker.
Right. He's a very engaged human being, and what's just horrific about his situation is that the state has tried to strip him of that intellectual vitality, although clearly they failed miserably because he continues to write, and he's written 6 books from death row. He's got his radio journals that are aired weekly. And he's got a phalanx of visitors who really keep him alive.
What can listeners turn to learn how to get involved in the Free Mumia movement? Do you have any actions or events planned in the near future?
For more information on the case, you should log on to emajonline.com. That's E M as in Mary, A J as in Johanna, online.com. And there you will find lots of very important information on the case. There's a section that's called Breaking News, which is quite useful. There will be lots of information on what you can do. The first thing that the movement is asking people to do is to arm themselves with the facts of the case. Then you can actually go online and sign a petition that's calling for a civil rights investigation on the case. It's a petition to the Department of Justice and Eric Holder. There's another petition calling on Obama to make a statement on the case and to review the case. You can also sign that petition. If you're a student or a university professor, we encourage you to join EMOJ and to help us organize for this large town hall meeting that we are organizing for April 3rd. That will likely be held here in New York. We are considering Columbia University, NYU, or Baruch as a place where that will be held. And you can show the films on the case, like
A Case for Reasonable Doubt,
which was an HBO documentary that was released in the 90s. Most recently, the Sundance Channel aired In Prison My Whole Life. That's a perfect way to educate people around the case. Actually, this is something that should be taken up during Black History Month by colleges all over the country and all over the city right here in New York. A film screening of either of these films would be a great Black History Month activity.
Those are great ideas, Johanna, and we'll have that information, all those links, up on our website, lawanddisorder.org. It's been a real pleasure to have you on, and we thank you for all the work and commitment you have put into this case. It is, as we say on Law and Disorder, one of the most important cases that confronts us right now because it represents so much of the injustice in this system.
Thank you, Johanna.
Thank you for having me.
We go now to hear a speech from the Gaza Freedom March Report Back from Palestinian teacher and filmmaker Fida Kishta.
I will mention another thing that people here ask me about. Like, they ask me about the houses that destroyed in 2009 because they said that they attacked these houses and destroyed 17,000 houses because of Hamas fighters. I kept laughing about this number and kept laughing about the reason that they used to say that we destroyed these houses because of Hamas. But my house destroyed in 2004. Hamas were not in power, they were not there. And 3,000 houses destroyed as well at that time. You didn't see them. I can tell from your faces that maybe people didn't hear about this number of houses that destroyed in 2004. But right now for the people in Gaza, you can find people in their homes, people in tents that lost their homes, and they cannot rebuild their homes. Why? Is that because they don't have money? Is that because, what kind of reason why they didn't rebuild their homes? And now we are a year after the CAS-led operation. Why they didn't start rebuilding their homes? One of the reasons that the Israeli army and the Israeli authorities said that they will not allow the building and materials enter Gaza. And why they said because of Hamas that they use the building materials like the cement to make rockets thrown to Sderot settlement or other Israeli settlements. But also, it's fun for Palestinians to think about it a little bit. Why? Is it real reason? Or what exactly the reason? I think now they're talking about a new operation. Maybe they didn't want some Palestinians to lose their homes twice, so they kept keeping them wet for more houses to be destroyed, and then they will open the borders for the building materials, who knows. But for the people in Gaza, I'm sending this message because many people asked me to send this message to the people around the world. We don't need food, and we don't want money. It's true that we can stay. Like, my family ate the same food for a year. Lentil, it's not bad, it's great. We need to feel free. We need a freedom. Go out, come back, feel a human. You all feel a human. If you wait at a checkpoint, you can imagine yourself waiting at the airport for a couple of weeks because you cannot go to your state. I don't think one of you can imagine himself in a situation that he traveled from state to state and then he realized that he have to wait in that airport for a couple of weeks. I did. We waited, me and my family and hundreds of Palestinians at the crossing for 3 weeks inside the terminal. People want to feel free. They don't want food. This is what we don't want to. We can stay eating one meal a day. Patients want to go out for treatment. I saw many young guys, they died and their families saw them. Orphans, they saw their parents killed. Do you think that these children who saw their parents killed in front of their eyes will forget that and say, let's start peace talks or whatever? They saw their parents, their cousins, their families killed in front of their eyes. They will not forget that easily. And these are the bombs for Israel. It's not the suicide bombers that always keep talking about this subject that we became, it's really boring subject to talk about. These kids who saw everything in their eyes, we don't teach our kids to hate the Israelis as children. When I teach, I'm a teacher as well. Most of the time when I teach the kids, never hate children like you. Whatever his race, whatever his nationality, even Israelis as children, they are children like you. You don't deserve to put this hate in your heart because they are children. No matter what, you are the same. But the problem is, what they see in Gaza every day, it's give them the experience. And they became older than the age. I was teaching kids 10 years old, and when I talked to them, I felt like, oh my God, 10 years old, no. They felt like, I felt like they are 16 and 17. I never felt that they are children. So again, the message of the people in Gaza, it's not a message of need money or food. We need to be free. We need to feel this, not just talk about it. When I left Gaza, I said, okay, I said to my family, goodbye, I'm gonna see you maybe in a couple of months after I get my training and return back. And I'm here in the United States after 5 months, actually 7 months now. I cannot go back to Gaza for different reasons. One of the reasons, the Egyptians, our neighbors. So I can imagine how many Palestinians left Gaza Strip and cannot go back. Maybe here you can jump, just book a ticket and go to your family, see them whenever you want. For me, no. I cannot go whenever I want. I have to wait the crossing, and when they open it, then I have to enter. And sometimes we wait weeks at the crossing. So again, the message of the people, it's not the need of food, it's not the need of clothes or contributions that people here just send them food. We don't want this again and again and again. We don't want this. We want to feel free. I want to go back home. I want to go out whenever I want. I want to feel a human. I want to be myself like you all. And this is my message to you, and this is the message of the Gazans in Gaza Strip that felt like you need to feel like people in Gaza is like you. They are not different. They are not from different planet. They are on the earth. We are on the different part. We have different culture. But we are human. Do you see the skin of me? Is it different of you? If I get hurt, what's going to come out? It's a blood like your blood. It's red. All of us had the same blood. I don't think I'm going to have blue blood. So we're all the same. So think of it this way. Humanitarian side. It's not a conflict. We need you to feel like we are humans, and this is what we need as well. Thanks a lot.
you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.